Want to learn how to resolve conflicts more skillfully, how to be sensitive to others while still meeting your own needs, how to have easier and deeper relationships? You can do all this and support WERU Community Radio at the same time on Saturday and Sunday, March 21st and 22nd, 9 to 4, when Peggy Smith of Open Communications will offer an introductory workshop in nonviolent communication called From Conflict to Connection, an Introduction to the Basics of Nonviolent Communication. The weekend-long training is a fundraiser for WERU and will be held at the Bagadoos Music Lending Library's gathering space in Blue Hill. The value of the workshop is $140, but whatever donation participants can afford will be accepted. Pre-registration is strongly recommended. For information, please go to weru.org. Support for WERU comes from DeMonte Berlian Arts, photography and creative services in Maine at berlianarts.com. That's berlianarts.com.
It's just a few seconds before 10 o'clock, and you are tuned to WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online everywhere at weru.org. Maine Arts Alive with your host Michael Donahue is up next.
And greetings, one and all. Welcome to Maine Arts Alive. And I am your host, Michael Donahue. This Maine Arts Alive is WERU's attempt to reach out to the arts community and let this wonderful community be known to everyone throughout the state. We are so lucky in Maine to have the kind of artists and arts organizations that we have. Many other states could not brag as we do the caliber of the folks that are our artists and arts community. So, a perfect example of what I just talked about is this a series I'm doing kind of called Leaders in Transition. Our guest today, Linda Nelson, who's the producing artistic director of the Stonington Opera House, is a leader and is in transition. So, Linda, greetings. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Wonderful to have you here because you fit in the topic just perfectly.
Excellent.
Yeah. There's a couple of things I'd like to go through here today. Let's start off with the Opera House itself, the organization that you have been leading. As I understand it, being in Stonington is not different from the way you grew up. You grew up in another Stonington, is that correct?
I did, and it's always a pleasure to be talking with you and the entire WERU community. It's very much my home here.
I read somewhere that when you grew up in Connecticut, you were known as a wharf rat. What is that, good or bad?
It's excellent if you're if you're somebody who likes the water. Of course, Stonington, Connecticut is quite a bit more developed than Stonington, Maine. It's halfway between New York and Boston, almost perfectly halfway. But it is full of boats and is the last lobstering community, actually, in Connecticut. And I grew up in the marinas and on the docks and slipping and sliding and gassing and fueling and rowing little rowboats and learning how to sail at the Mystic Seaport and basically on the water my entire life.
Well, so you're coming to Stonington, Maine, and all of a sudden seeing this rundown structure. This was, what year was this,
1997 was the first time, 1998 was when we got the vision.
There was a quote in one of the articles about you. I'm going to read its quick quote. He said, when I walked into the main door of the Opera House and stood in the stinky, falling down, dark, raccoon-inhabited theater, what did you think?
It was a startling moment, and I know many of your listeners have heard us talk about this, because it's not often one gets to really talk about having a vision in one's life. And this was a particularly dark and rundown space. The electricity wasn't on. It was inhabited by a family of six raccoons. It was flooded so that the driveway was occupying half of the building and the whole northern sill was rotted. People that come to the Opera House today kind of can't imagine what it actually looked like at that point, because now it looks like what it's supposed to look like. But we, both Judith and I, Judith Jerome, who's the founding artistic director, and I had visions at that moment standing in the dark there of what the potential of the place could be and might mean to the community. And I think that's what the entire organization has been built upon.
This term community keeps coming back over and over, and I want to get to that. But a little bit more about this dilapidated structure that was, if my records are correct, it was built around 1886 or so, somewhere in that area.
There's been an opera house on that particular footprint since that time. This particular structure dates from 1912, which is why we celebrated its centennial a couple of years ago.
As a result of the fire.
In 1910.
Right. Mm-hmm. So this second life, you're really talking almost like a third life now.
At least, and I think that's true for many of our important facilities and institutions in rural Maine. They often have more than one life.
Yeah, and there in this fishing community of, I think I read somewhere there was a couple thousand people there and when the Opera House was first built. So the Opera House became very much a part of the community, a center for a lot going on. Then when it burned down, not only did it burn, but the population was reduced considerably.
True. In fact, there were almost 5,000 people in Stonington at the turn of the 20th century, and I always think it's wonderful for people to kind of wrap their minds around that image of Stonington. It's not how people think about Stonington today.
Yeah.
In the days of water transportation before the bridge was built, Stonington was, in fact, at the center of the world. Stonington now, in a car-driven transportation system, is at the end of the world and is not on the way to anywhere other than Idaho, which is definitely somewhere.
Right. Yeah.
But you don't pass through it to get to anywhere. It's not a service center. So people have to come to Stonington now truly as a destination, whereas before it was really a thriving commercial center. And with 5,000 workers, because it was a quarrying community in addition to being a fishing community, so it had more of a diversified economy and, in fact, had immigration of the stonecutters from various countries around the world there in order to support the industry.
But the thread from then till now has been in many ways that building.
It is one of the threads for sure, and it has been the cultural heart of the community for many, many years, and it has had its ups and downs. Certainly, as you noted, it was abandoned when we took it over. And it really, when you think about the Opera House and its role in Stonington, you really can almost see the map of the role that culture has played in many of our small communities across the country with the rise of different technologies such as the radio, the telephone. This is, you know, before TV, radio, telephone, then TV, then internet, and the ways those technologies shape our communities and our cultures.
But the point that you're making would seem to have a negative side as well. I mean, with the growth of all this communication and a causeway and a bridge, the role of the Opera House might have faded because there was more opportunity for the inhabitants down there to leave the area to get their entertainment somewhere else.
And that's true. That did happen. I mean, change always, always cuts both ways. And I think that hopefully there's very few people left that see progress as an unerring line going up into the sky. It's every time there's a major cultural change, you lose things as well as gain things. And that's part of what we tried to show last summer when we developed an original musical called The Last Ferryman, which was about the
which was quite a success.
It was a huge success. It sold out 8 shows, thanks in large part to the brilliance of our composer and lyricist, Paul Sullivan.
The one time when I was down there, someone was talking about the history of the Stonington, and they mentioned that it had been an ice skating rink once inside.
Roller skating rink.
What was a roller skating?
Not ice skating.
Oh,
thank
goodness.
Hopefully no ice inside.
Yeah, but it was a roller skating rink inside there.
Right. Many of these buildings have gone through multiple uses in their histories, and the Opera House is no stranger to that. It has a flat floor, which makes it a perfect multifunction space, and was used for dances, high school graduations, and roller skating for a short time in the 1960s.
Interesting. Now, this purchase, which occurred in the 98-99, turning your operation into a 501c3 nonprofit, your purchase price was in and around $90,000 to get this thing going.
Mm-hmm.
There was Judith Jerome, Carol Esty,
mm-hmm.
and Linda
Patty.
Patty, okay.
Right.
How did the four of you come together?
Carol and Judith were classmates at NYU in the master's program at the in the Performing Arts School. So, and Carol had grown up on the island in the summers. Her parents, Bud and Audrey Esty, were teachers at the French camp for girls, which the island was rather famous for, in Deer Isle. They were also, her mother was a founder of the Princeton Ballet in New Jersey. So a very deep and rich arts family and legacy to come from. Bud and Audrey were still alive when we were founding the Opera House, and that was delightful to have them in the front row at many of our shows. But Carol told Judith to look at the Opera House when we were in Stonington, and so it was Carol and her partner Linda to whom we came back to when we went back to New York and said, what do you think? Are you game? Do you want to try this?
And their first reaction was no, or was it overwhelming?
I wouldn't say it was no. I think it was surprise, though. Yeah. I mean, I think the sense of taking on a project like that is a surprising leap of faith for most people.
I mean, you've done, and we're going to get into this later, a ton of different stuff in your life so far. This was very different in many ways, to take on a dilapidated structure in a town called Stonington, which was almost off the map for many people.
It was very different, and also in some ways when I look back, I can see the thread that unites everything. I have always been an entrepreneur and responsible for starting things up. I'm one of the founders of the Women's Resource Center at Bowdoin College, which we founded in 1982 and which still exists today, I'm proud to say. I helped to found the Village Voice Media's new media division in the early 90s. So I can see my own trail as an entrepreneur. All those things are very different indeed, but I think I like to start things up that serve communities.
Yeah, I'm going to get a lot more into all the things that you are, because as I began to read the list, I thought, my God, this is all one person. you must be in a second life or something.
It takes a lot to keep me out of trouble.
But you've been successful so far. One of the interesting things about the Opera House when you founded it, if I'm quoting correctly, the mission of the 501c3 is to foster and promote excellence in the ways we perform our lives, incite art, and create community. Could you talk a little bit about that mission and how you fulfilled that?
I'd love to. I think it's a very important mission, and I'm not sure people always take the time to think about what it really means. In some ways, it derived particularly from Carol and Judith's work in performance studies, where we understand that everything we do, what you and I are doing now, what doctors do, what lawyers do, what fishermen do, is a performance. We perform our lives, and we're not always conscious of that. We sometimes feel like our lives are performing us, but in the best circumstances, we do perform our lives. And when we think about the nature of performance and what makes for a good performance, and I'm not talking about artifice here. I'm talking about presence, really, and often listening and improvisation, which is what we do with other people when we hear them. Jazz musicians embody it to the nth degree, but we all do it in our regular lives.
Yeah.
Leadership is a huge performance, and the qualities that make for good leaders are the same qualities that make good actors or good musicians. So our hope has always been that by using the performing arts, by bringing them to life in a community and working with community members of all ages, whether they are students or adults, on the skills of performance, that we would help to play a role to help improve and strengthen our community. And that's the kind of being of service role that I think Opera House Arts has always had as part of its mission.
in particular, that part of your mission which says incite art. You're in a fishing village. You're in a small town that perhaps the arts was not a major part of their upbringing. How did the Opera House help make a change into the Stonington today?
I'm never... I think that's a question for other people to answer, for those people whose lives are changed. I don't like to posit that the Opera House has been responsible in particular for any kind of change. For one thing, I think it's so important to recognize the legacy of the arts in our lives that we often ignore. So we think, oh, a place doesn't have a big performing arts center, there's no art there. But in fact, on the island, and as in many of these communities, music, kitchen table music, has been a part of people's lives forever. We have a thriving, you know, grassroots music community in Stonington, as many of our communities do. And the arts, in many ways, what we make with our hands, what we make with our lives, are often artistic creations. I just think it's not recognized enough, and too often what we call the capital A arts are separated from the daily art of living. But in our small communities, people have really focused on those daily arts of living. And so the stretch to say, let's actually go to a concert or go to a movie or enjoy participating in a play reading, I don't think it's as great as everybody makes it out to be. I think sometimes it's a practice that has been lost or a habit that has no longer been there.
Yeah.
And certainly with a winter like this one, which I just learned today was the coldest and the snowiest in 40 years,
yeah,
it's hard for people to want to come out of their houses and join together. But I think that's what theaters like the Opera House are really for. They're a space for gathering and a space for people to come together and share experiences. And it's that shared experience portion of it that I think we've been able to provide.
Boy, I really honor what you've just talked about. Some years ago, I was out in eastern Kentucky in the mountains. And you would think, looking at the area, that the arts are far removed from this territory. But I learned that the music that came out of that portion of the United States all started on porches. People would sit on a porch and play and sing. And I can just see the same thing with Stonington, is that the Opera House may have helped them realize that what they feel naturally exists on another level as well.
I just think it's all about making connections more than anything, and maybe widening experiences. We're very much encouraged from the time we're students now to kind of really focus on one track or focus on one thing and to believe that we can only do that or that that's what our life is about. And what the arts on a broader scale can do for us is, and certainly reading did this for me as a kid, as did music, is help us know that the world is a much larger place, and to fill us with the wonder and the joy of that kind of expanded world is beyond our spheres, even if we're not, if it's not something we do or participate in, but
yeah,
that it exists out there. And I think that magic of imagination, that magic of creativity and connecting one's own creativity to that broader spectrum is the kind of role that arts organizations like Opera House Arts can play.
We're talking with Linda Nelson, who's the producing artistic director of the Stonington Opera House. And about to go through transition, which is the kind of the subject of this morning's conversation, is leaders in transition. This idea of community is one that has been a part of your life in more ways than one. I'm fascinated about that part of your life, which was the Village Voice in New York. The infamous Village Voice. What was your role down there, and what did you learn from that experience?
It was a terrific place to grow up. I was lucky enough to set my sights on New York because I always wanted to be a writer, and New York was the place. And so
yes,
after I graduated from Bowdoin, I moved down to New York, and I lived there for 16 years before moving up here. And, you know, like many of the things I've done in my life, just kind of following an open door or following an intuition. And again, you know, not like, okay, I'm going to plan and plan and plan and get my degree and make sure that I've got all my MCATs and LSATs and all my initials towed up behind my name. Very more serendipitous. And maybe that was more applicable to those times than it can be today. I'm not exactly sure, but I do encourage it in the young people that I work with to follow their intuitions and follow their hearts a little bit. I moved down there without a job, applied for anything I could get. The first job I applied for was working part-time at the Village Voice. And that is basically how my career there started. By the time I was finished, 13 years later, I was the chief information officer, and we had started up a new media division. So my role changed while there in 13 years quite a bit. And I think that this kind of constant change, especially in the job world, is more and more part of our lives. Nothing stays the way it used to when, you know, our fathers might have worked in the same factory for 40 years. Stonington is a bit of a throwback in that regard. We have generations of families that have gone fishing and that continue to go fishing. Right. And it's a lovely, lovely tradition and really almost anomalous in the American experience these days.
But here across from me sits a woman who was born in Stonington, Connecticut, and is now working in the heart of Manhattan with the Village Voice. What kind of transitions were there for you in that?
I think a lot of my transitions to the Voice were because of my sense of community and grassroots activism. And my community and grassroots activism were forged by coming out very young as a lesbian and getting involved with lesbian feminism in the late 1970s. Those communities were very, very strong then, very strong, very active, very much promoting social change. And that forged me and forged in me a great desire to work with other people to continually improve our lives and to fight for social justice and to just make whatever we can around us a little bit of a better place. I mean, I was also raised Catholic, so I had the whole Dorothy Day sense of social justice back there and of community service. So kind of building on these layers of that belief, you know, going to work at The Voice, which was an alternative voice, telling different stories, not telling the same story, giving us different insights into what meaning we might find in the news, in the arts. Promoting different stories and different voices was extremely important to me and a kind of a next step in regard to that.
I just can't help but imagine. I mean, I grew up in the 60s as well, and the Village Voice was almost a goal for so many of us. What the Village Voice said was true.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did Village Voice report the news, but it made the news, which is an interesting dynamic for a wharf rat to come to that point, I would imagine. We mentioned a couple things, times that you seem to have accomplished a number of things so far. And I just started listing some areas of expertise that you possess. Strategic planning, management, budgeting, organizational development, working with startups. You're a freelance writer, reporter, editor, worked with new media. Where is it going?
I think my history is not that different from many artists. I think it is really, hopefully, about the creative life and the creative path and how we each choose to fulfill that in ourselves. I think, as I've said, the thread that connects all these things for me is a kind of entrepreneurial sense of social justice and service and wanting to continually improve life for others, especially those who have not been as lucky or as blessed as I've been in my life. So, as you know, I'm headed to the Maine Arts Commission to become the assistant director there. I hope to continue to spread the power of the arts to places and people in the state and to use the arts to unite our communities and to strengthen our communities as much as possible.
Again, we're talking with Linda Nelson, who is about to make a change from the Opera House to the Maine Arts Commission, as you said, as of May 1st. Is that correct?
Right, the beginning of May.
All right. So what are you going to be doing at the Maine Arts Commission?
The assistant director job, and I'm sorry that Julia Richards, the executive director, isn't here with us today,
listening, so be careful.
it's a very functional management kind of position, helping to really streamline operations. My hope is to always to make the operations under the hood of any organization, whether it's Opera House Arts or the Maine Arts Commission, as effective as possible and as inclusive as possible, so that more of the budget can be devoted to programming, which in the case of the Arts Commission is to funding the arts in Maine, and so that as many people feel connected to the Arts Commission and as many artists feel served by the Arts Commission as possible.
You once said in an article, I use my hunger for learning and curiosity for the world. How do you use your hunger for learning?
Wow, Michael, I don't know where you're digging these things up. And good research on your part. I grew up as a voracious reader and grew up in a very, very small family and small working class community. And the world was very narrow, and I always wanted to know more of it. And reading and music took me there, as I said. So I think there's that hunger. And I think almost all children and students have that hunger, and I think most adults maintain that. I think it gets buried under the day-to-day. I think it gets buried under the hierarchy of needs, if you will, in terms of you know, housing, food, you know, and emotional safety and physical safety. We are so lucky in this country. I mean, most of us have never lived in a war-torn environment. We don't have to worry about that level of safety. But in our homes and in our lives, there is still a lot of insecurity and lack of safety. And, you know, I hope that we're all hungry to do better and to make the world a better place for those who are less fortunate than we are. And that's kind of what I meant by that hunger, that drive to do that. You know, when we feel as if we've been privileged and by going to Bowdoin College on scholarship, I mean, I was extremely privileged and got a wonderfully privileged education. As the great lesbian feminist writer Audre Lorde always said, so what will you do with that privilege? You can't I hope that we don't take our privileges for granted. I hope that we always are using them in the power for others.
In many ways, and this, I guess this is more just a gut feeling on my part, is that in many ways, Maine really is a place for artists and arts organizations to take chances and mature and grow. There just seems to be, especially in this peninsula, Blue Hill Peninsula, that down to Stonington, there seems to be a corridor of artists growing and maturing and feeding their hunger.
Well, I love that vision that you have, Michael, that caused you to start this show. I love that you understand that about the arts in Maine and the power of the arts in Maine. Maine has more individual artists per capita than any other state in the nation.
Yes.
Which means for the size of our population, there are more people that see themselves as artists than anywhere else, which is impressive in a rural state. I think that the beauty and the rural nature of the state and the sense of community in our small communities as well as in our larger communities – help to support the makers that are here. And as you said just now, to support experimentation and invention. And that's a wonderful thing to have. There are many challenges, too, in this state to that. But those are things that we can really build on and continue to advance for people.
You are listening to WERU, Maine Arts Alive. We are 89.9 on the FM dial, 99.9 in the Bangor area. And in a few moments, I would offer you the opportunity to join in this conversation. I will give out a phone number quite soon. But it's important that you know that this is WERU Community Radio. And as Community Radio, it is our service to the community to bring folks like Linda to your attention, and to help the arts and the artists of the state grow and mature, as we were just talking about. So thank you for listening to WERU. We've got a half hour to go with Linda. And as I say, let's give out the phone numbers. What the heck? We only live once. 469-0500. That's 469-0500. And 800 numbers 1-866 469-625-9378. Do it one more time, 469-0500 or 1-866-625-9378. And it is half past the hour. Linda, I hate to coach you all the time, but that's what I'm doing here. You said in an article in the Ellsworth American recently that all good leaders know when to step aside for the next generation. Is that what transition is all about?
I think that when one founds an organization, as we did with Opera House Arts, it's especially important to know when the next generation for new ideas is coming in. I think founders have a tendency, because it's their baby, and I think everybody knows that Opera House Arts is my baby, and I love it dearly. And so this is a very emotional transition for me as well. But that I think that it's really important to make room, that it doesn't just happen, that new leaders don't just kind of force their way in or emerge, that it's important to make space for the leaders that exist, to make space and to encourage, by creating that space, the next new thing to come in. And I think that what we're going to see at Opera House Arts is the next new thing, while it will maintain Opera House Arts' mission, will also result in new flowers that we can't even predict at this moment. And it's that unpredictable nature of change that is so exciting.
Amen. And you are in the catbird seat. I have Kirsten, if I'm pronouncing that right.
No,
name,
it's Kristen.
From Belfast. Good morning. What's your thoughts?
Yes, it's Kristen.
I'm sorry, Kristen.
First of all, I am delighted that Linda is going to be the assistant Maine Arts Commission director. And I just want, as an aside, I moved to Belfast, Maine, about 30 years ago from New York City to be an artist, which Maine allowed me to do, and I'm a photographer. But the first time I came to Maine was in 1959 when I was 10, and I stayed with an artist friend of my mother's.
Could I interrupt just a second? Yeah. We're having a little trouble hearing you. You could speak
better?
Up. Oh, that's much better. Yeah.
I came to 30 years, well, no, when I was 10, to 1959, to spend some time in Maine, and we were in right outside of Stonington. And I went to see Some Like It Hot at the Stonington Opera House, and I'll never forget it.
It was terrific.
One of the highlights of my life.
That is a terrific story.
Yeah. But I wanted you to know that. But I was for a number of years director of the Belfast Arts Council, mm-hmm. and the need here, I think, in a place like some of the coastal communities that are becoming very popular with people from all over the world, is it becomes too popular, and there's gentrification that creeps in,
mm-hmm.
and then the art. I mean, one of the reasons we came and left New York City was to find a place that we could afford. And if you don't have affordable places for artists to live, it becomes very hard for them to do real creative work and take chances. And I mean, that is a really major point. But of course, there are new places springing up all the time. My husband and I were recently in Lübeck. And I was surprised to find quite a few artists living there, because Belfast is too expensive anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Very, very interesting thoughts. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Kristen, that's a really great story about the Opera House. Thanks so much for calling to share that, and also to share your thoughts on gentrification. It's been a real concern of mine. When I moved to New York City, I moved into a section of Brooklyn called Williamsburg, which at that time was a rundown factory neighborhood, as my family kindly called it, a slum. Much abandonment, much drug use, much crime, and they were pretty appalled that I was living there. If you go to Williamsburg today, it is high-rise condos from wall to wall. Many artists, for sure, that have spilled over from the East Village and from Greenwich Village in Manhattan. But I would have been priced out there now, and many artists are also. And they, as artists, we keep moving further and further toward the edges because we're experimental. environmental, and we are kind of pioneers, and we're not afraid of renovating old buildings or living close to the bone. The problem is, if we don't pay attention to the gentrification that kind of follows in our wakes as we make our communities more attractive for people that have more money, which I think the arts do, that kind of unchecked gentrification does exactly what, Kristen, what you were saying, and really changes the nature of our working waterfronts in our communities. We've been really conscious of that at Opera House Arts. I'm not sure that we've kind of kept our finger in the dike, so to speak. There's been a lot of change in Stonington over the last years as well. And I would urge all of us who are artists to kind of consider that gentrification is not just a force, an uncontrolled force on its own, that there are ways that we can be conscious of it, be conscious of our role in it, and engage in practices that might limit its impact on our communities. Some of these include being really involved with our municipalities. I'm very involved with our town's economic development program, thinking about how the wider economic development beyond the arts, what our impact is really there, how we affect property values, what we can do to mitigate that effect on property values, how we can work for affordable housing, not just for artists, but also for fishermen. All of these things, I think, are really important issues, and I thank you for raising them because it has been a big consideration of ours at Opera House Arts.
This was certainly true of Philadelphia back in the 60s. The People's Theater and Light Company had opened in really the fringe of decent Philadelphia, quote-unquote, into not a slum, but certainly not the place that most people would want to be at night. And within a decade, the whole thing had changed into the best place to live in Philadelphia. The arts... You know, there's a dichotomy here. There's a responsibility on the arts, but there's also a responsibility on the part of the community. And I guess that relationship that you've developed with the Opera House, with the community, is the key.
Well, I don't think there's a dichotomy, Michael, and I think in part that might be part of the issue. I think we as artists really need to see ourselves as citizens just like anybody else. So we True. Are the people that need to serve on the planning boards. We need to serve on the school boards. I just came off a 3-year term on our school board last year. We need to see that it's the benefit of the whole community and not just of our own interests. And this goes for everybody, not just artists. I don't want to pull a Patricia Arquette here and be talking about artists. It's true, I think, for us as citizens and keeping the widest view of what makes us good community members and how do we engage around the issues that matter and that really impact our community. And the truth is we do want arts organizations and artists to increase prosperity in our communities, to improve the quality of life in our communities. As we do that, we will attract more funding, more money, more wealthy people because of an enhanced and different kind of quality of life. If we're going to play that role, we need to be able to balance it and work on the other side of it as well and think what is really important to maintaining the existing fabric and texture of our working communities.
Our phone number is 469-0500, or if you like 800 numbers, 1-866-625-9378. Join the conversation. I want to go back for just a step here to talk about leaders in transition. As you've said, and I think it's very true, you and Judith have become known as the Stonington Opera House. You have the power behind it, the drivers, oftentimes if someone says Linda Nelson, people immediately know the Opera House. How is the next leader going to be able to deal with that force that you leave behind?
I think that we as leaders have been very aware of that since the beginning, and you'll also find quotes that say that we never wanted the Opera House to really be about us as individuals. And the biggest sign of that is that we had a real choice back in 1998. We could have purchased the Opera House as private individuals and leased it to a nonprofit or leased it to people that wanted to operate it as an arts organization. And in that case, as private investors, we would have been able to accrue the tax credits, et cetera, that go along with rehabbing historic buildings. We didn't have that kind of money necessarily. But more importantly, we really saw the Opera House as belonging to its community and not to us. So we started the nonprofit before we started it in order to to restore the Opera House. So it's been a nonprofit from the start, which to me is a community-based organization. It's a board of directors. It's a community advisory board. It's an artistic advisory
board.
It's
meeting a need.
It's volunteers. Yeah, right. It's hopefully providing services towards community that are important and that have value. But it's much bigger than us as individuals. That said, I'm not going to dismiss the fact that leaders hold a particular kind of space and can create a vacuum effect that might make it difficult for others to follow. We really hope that isn't the case, and I don't think it is the case because we have such a broad base of support. We have such a wonderful board of directors, such a strong group of volunteers, and so many people who have ownership of that institution that I think that it is much bigger than Judith or I as individuals. And I think what we'll see is the next person adding vision and energy to it and taking it on to the next thing.
Well, the next person will be coming on top of some completion of some major plans, some renovation, and I want to get into that. But I've got a gentleman on the phone from Brooklyn. David, is that your name, sir?
That is.
Yes. Yeah. Could you speak up? We're having a little trouble hearing today.
Okay. I just wanted to thank you for the very interesting program and history.
Whoops. That often happens. Someone is calling from a cell phone, and we can have intermittent receipt. David, I'm sorry. Call back if you can, preferably on a landline. But thank you for your comments, as brief as they may have been. Okay. We go back to that quote of yours, that all good leaders know when to step aside. How do you know when to step aside?
That's a good question. And again, I'm not sure whether it's anything more than intuition. It's also careful planning and careful working with the broader base of your organization. We started succession planning about 3 years ago now. We knew that Judith was going to want to retire as artistic director, and we started to put a plan in place for that and really thinking about my own transition as well and what kind of newness in terms of vision the Opera House might require at that point. So this has been a very staged transition with Judith's retirement as artistic director. She is still working as an artistic consultant on special projects with the Opera House, and I think that's
important. She's traveling now, right?
She's currently traveling, working on her own artistic projects, and that's a wonderful thing. But then the next step was to have to consolidate the two positions. When, you know, most theaters our size, and we're only about a $750,000 a year budget. So for all of the work that happens down there, all of the maintenance of those buildings, that is not a great deal of money.
No.
We support eight now full-time year-round positions, so we create jobs as well. And I think what we did was we said, okay, we don't need two leaders here. That was an outcome of the nature of the founders, that we had these skills and these relationships. Most companies our size have a producing artistic director. So my job was to make that transition this year, create the position of producing artistic director so that there is one person to replace and not two. And in doing that, build the staff up underneath that position so that it's a strong structure. We have always had many strong individuals, and I can't say enough about the staff at Opera House Arts. They are fantastic. And our general manager, Jennifer Morrow, in particular, is a real leader in her own right and really is the rock on which the operations are based. So I think that we've made that transition now. We also had a vision for the building, which you were alluding to little bit earlier.
Please get to that.
Which needed two additional kinds of functionality before we felt it completed the scene, as we call it, and completed our vision for it. We do high quality Actors Equity professional productions there, which require scenic design and scenic builds that are comparable to some of the bigger and better theaters and cities around the country. We've been building all those sets outdoors or indoors with health risks to our volunteers and staff. So we're building a scene shop. And then in response to our audience who would like a little bit more comfortable experience in a more than 100-year-old building, we're expanding a lobby and adding restrooms so that when we're full with 280 people packed in there, people can move around a bit more freely and experience some of the other parts of being together in a way that's more pleasant than current.
Well, I know a couple people that their ears picked up when you said more restrooms.
Indeed.
The talking about goings-on, you are doing a community-staged play reading the 24th and 25th of this month at 7 p.m. Can you talk a little bit about that? That sounds fascinating. It's called Our Own.
Thank you. It's the Our Own Community Stage Play Reading Series has been one of the cornerstones of Opera House Arts since 2001. We started it in our second year here, realizing that it's not always possible to put up the fully staged types of productions that I was just discussing in the need for a scene shop, but to involve community members in ways that doesn't require a significant challenge for them. To allow them to read significant works of art, of literature together. We could do it without requiring memorization. We could do it and give people a taste of the stage and of what it means to be on the stage and reading these works through this play reading series. So we started with the Vagina Monologues back in 2001, and we've done many issue-oriented play readings, and this one, Appropriate, by Brandon Jacobs Jenkins, is no different. February is Black History Month. Sometimes here in northern Maine, down east Maine, it's difficult for us to remember that because our population is so homogenous, but it's always been important to me, especially having lived in New York, and I like to celebrate Black History Month every year. So I selected this play because it is a way to talk about themes of racism in a very personal way in the context of a white family. So we can do it with a white cast without stretching too much, and but still think about and discuss and engage with issues that are important to our Black communities in this country and to the heritage of those Black communities in our country.
Of course, it always brings Lorraine Hansberry to mind and her wonderful work. I work with a play reading group in Blue Hill, and we just read The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window, which was her last play, and very much about all of the subjects which you just talked about. It's a gorgeous play. And you'll have a guest artist, David Mason, his students like Luke Ghetto and Kate Hutchinson, Marvin Merritt, and some of the names that you folks know from the community will be in. Bob Burke, he's everywhere. Nancy Green, Amy Kaiser, Kirsten Reed, Alice Wilkinson. That's quite a crew.
It's a great cast. I feel really lucky to work with them. And, you know, it's a difficult, complicated text. This is a dysfunctional family that gathers at the rundown family plantation in Arkansas after the patriarch passes away. And in cleaning out the house, they discover artifacts of somebody's engagement with the Ku Klux Klan and some pretty kind of horrifying artifacts, including a photograph album of lynching photographs. It's never revealed in the play how those might have come to be in the house. They could have belonged to the grandfather. Who knows? But the emotional impact of discovering these things on both the adults in the room and on their children is really worth listening to, I think, and engaging with.
Especially with the cast you've got. There's some strong actors there.
We're really blessed to have a lot of strong actors in our community. Yeah. And as you mentioned, Bob Burke, of course, is one of them. Yeah. Also, Amy Kaiser, who people may not be as familiar with her name yet, but she is Opera House Arts Development and Artistic Associate, and she is a very fine actor in her own right.
I'm going to give you another quote.
Oh, my goodness. You're going to embarrass me, Michael.
It's not about money or property for us. It's about living a good life, doing what you think is important, and giving something to the community. Does that kind of sum it up?
For me, it does. And, you know, you only hope that you can make that happen. as I said earlier, I'm not the one to judge whether we've been able to make a positive difference for our community. I think that's for others to do, but that's all we've ever wanted to do.
Yeah. Are there any, I know I didn't warn you about this, so if there's nothing comes to mind, that's fine. But I'm wondering if as you leave the Opera House and as you start a new venture, what are some of the things that you will take with you from that experience in Stonington?
There's so many answers come to mind. It's a little bit difficult to answer that question. There's so much that I will take with me. But certainly the people and the sense of creativity. I think I might be repeating myself, but I think it's easier to overlook creativity in our everyday lives. And in a fishing community in particular, the ingenuity and intelligence and creativity that goes into being a good fisherman is incredible. And life on the water is its own kind of time and its own kind of place. And the fact that I've been able to work with fishermen and families and in a community that is half water, really, and half land has really enriched my soul a great deal. And I am very thankful for that, very grateful for it.
The nature of change inherent in transition, as we've talked, can be a two-edged sword. But this seems like this transition from Stonington into the Maine Arts Commission, taking on this new role, is a big step. What is it that you want to gain for yourself as an artist by making this step?
That's a wonderful question. People are, asking me, why I'm deciding to leave. It's kind of one of our artists that we were talking to recently had a great analogy for this because he was talking about change in his own life. And he said, yeah, people are wondering, I have this great job. And it's kind of like you're a jumper. The word is eluding me, but you're up in an airplane and you've got your parachute ready and you're getting ready to jump out of the airplane, right? You're ready to skydive. And
are you speaking from experience?
No, I'm not. Okay. I am not. I love airplanes, but I do not like falling. But this gentleman was saying, he said, the door is open and you've got this perfectly good plane that's flying beautifully, yet you want to jump out of it. And what is that? What is that impulse? And that's how it is with Opera House Arts. I mean, Judith and I, there was no reason we had to leave. We felt like the timing was correct for the institution, and we were hoping we were doing the right thing by that. And we both had exciting creative challenges ahead of us. And I think my challenge with the Arts Commission is really to broaden my sense of service to the state. I talked about going to Bowdoin and feeling really the privilege of that education and the privilege of being in Maine since the late 70s. And I constantly wonder how can I benefit the people of Maine in broader ways. So hopefully that's my challenge, how I can help with my skill set that I've got, help the commission to bring people together and to further support our communities through the arts and creative means. That's what I'm looking for, I think, Michael.
Wow. Okay. Well articulated, I feel. Also, I wanted to mention that the movie Birdman is going to be showing. What perfect timing to have brought that in.
Sometimes you get lucky. We joke about sometimes having our finger on the pulse. But in fact, this is it's an amusing story. In fact, we were supposed to have shown Birdman last week before it won the Best Picture Oscar. And we had a mechanical breakdown in our beautiful big digital projector that we struggled with and gnashed our teeth about and had to cancel the movie for. And that's in addition, of course, to the various rounds of snow that we've been battling. We work hard to keep the theater open open all year. I think most theaters in the state, there's only really four of the Equity theaters that are open year-round. The other three are only open seasonally.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, it's a challenge, but we're really dedicated to it. And I hope that as Opera House Arts continues, it will continue its dedication to the year-round community and to keeping that building open year-round. So anyway, Birdman, yes.
This Friday.
Just won the Best Picture Oscar.
Yeah.
We already have it booked. It's in-house. It's Friday, Saturday at 7, Sunday at 2. Come see it right in Stonington.
I don't know why they didn't mention that at the ceremonies that it's going to be up here.
I know. It was a lost opportunity for them. Indeed.
Yes. Linda, thank you so much for stopping by and for talking about the Opera House, your journey, your leadership. Very much appreciated having you here today.
Michael, thank you so much for inviting me and for all that you do in support of the arts, both here locally and around the state. Thank you.
A couple of things that I just wanted to share with folks before we turn it over to our engineers, and that is that coming up March 1st, the Minetti Quartet of the Blue Hill Concert Association will be in Blue Hill. This Blue Hill Concert Association, which I have some connections with, is a marvelous organization, and that Minetti Quartet is going to be, I think, well worth hearing. The ticket's still available. And I don't have a phone number here, but you can look it up. I don't know why I don't. Also, the Blue Hill Bach Organization is going to be celebrating Bach's birthday Friday, March 20th at 7:30 with a wonderful program. So if you're familiar with them, again, there's a phone number of 613-5454. But having attended a number of those performances, I can attest to the fact that whatever they do is worth going to. And lastly, I just wanted to mention something that I find fascinating. This comes out of the Maine Center for Creativity, which is based down in Portland. And the event's going to be in Portland. But boy, folks, if you're down there, go see this. This is the Maine Center for Creativity presents the Art and Science of Creativity, an evening with Edison Liu, who is the president and CEO of Jackson Laboratory. And he's going to be talking about tracking through music and literature the commonality between art and science and how human beings are hardwired to create. Linda, does that strike true?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's terrific. I'm so glad to hear that event is happening.
Thursday, April 2nd, 5:30 to 7:30 in the evening down at USM Hannaford Hall. That's Thursday, April 2nd. And if you haven't heard this gentleman speak, absolutely, you should go hear this gentleman who knows as much about music and the arts as he does about the work of Jackson Lab. Tickets are $35, and you can call 730-0694. Well, that's it for Maine Arts Alive, folks. Thank you for tuning in. We hope to see you same time, same station next year. And Amy Brown, who's our engineer, thank you as always. Angie, good night.